Welcome back to part two of the Castaneda Hyman Show. This is Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and we're going to carry on the conversation that we began last week. And Eddie, we're going to come back to you with what some other areas that you think have been really quite novel and new. And in fact, I know a little bit already what your guys are going to talk about. Border studies. So what on earth is a psychologist going to be doing with border studies?
You know, anything that has to do with behavior is what psychology is about. And so psychology enters into many different kinds of problems that in society. I think the one that I'd like to focus on is that challenge of translational work, where you take basic neurological research, animal research, and how it applies to a human condition. And so I think I'd like to highlight the work of one of my colleagues, Dr. Sergio Iniguez, who's studying some work looking at physical stress versus just witnessed stress. And he has a very unique model where...
Just explain what that means. Physical stress means you actually do something to the species, the animal, the person. The other is just you see something unpleasant, and that's...
That's right. And these are two different types of stresses that are combined in the manipulation. So experimentally, he has one strain of mouse that's typically a larger mouse in its home environment, and introduces a small mouse into the home environment of the larger mouse. The larger mouse will attack the small mouse, and I'll make sure to clarify that we don't allow any mice to be hurt. Okay, so these are very controlled studies. But there's a physical interaction between the two animals, and of course, the larger animal will dominate. And so this smaller animal experiences physical stress. In the meantime, there's a see-through clear wall, and on the other side of this wall, there's another mouse of the same strain as a smaller one that simply observes that interaction.
And can hear also?
And can hear also, because there's some small holes drilled so that the animal can also experience the smells and the sounds. And so it turns out that there's long-term changes in terms of sensitivity to drugs of abuse in both the animal that experiences physical abuse as well as the observed stress. And I think that's just fascinating to think about how that translates to our border situation.
What are you measuring to indicate this is happening?
So what's really unique about this research is that it's very interdisciplinary. It measures protein changes in the brain, and it measures the propensity for an animal to intake, ingest a drug of abuse. There's an increased propensity for drug abuse, if you will, in this model.
For both the animal that's in with the big bully and the one who's watching it.
Absolutely.
So there's a
yes.
parallel response from the one outside to the one inside.
Yes.
That's
mm-hmm.
what the end result is saying, right?
That's correct. And so we're looking at changes in vulnerability and in resilience as well. Yeah.
I remember just about 2 weeks ago on the BBC, they had a program very appropriate for this discussion, that one of the BBC reporters went, I think, to France or Denmark, I can't remember which, for participate in an experiment where she was on the outside, let's say, mm-hmm. watching someone on the inside. But the one on the inside, and this is metaphorical inside, I mean, they were both in the same location, was being given electrical stimulations to some part of the body. And, you know, this was not exactly painful, but uncomfortable. And they were both measuring their brain responses. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the person who was being subjected to the electrical stimulation, and therefore pain to a certain extent, certainly discomfort, certain parts of the brain would light up. The person watching was also being looked at, similar parts of the brain. That is, that they were talking about empathy, that it is clearly showing that people are rather empathetic. And what they see, they can actually feel for themselves. Same idea, perhaps.
That's right. Those are called mirror neurons, where the same brain circuits turn on. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of studies with animals that show that, for example, in non-human primates, if you show an animal that a different animal is picking up a ball, for example, the areas that are involved in the motor control of that sequence of movements in the observing animal also light up.
Oh, but, I see that in football. I watch a lot of English soccer, and I'm always kicking the ball when I think it should be kicked.
What's really quite interesting is that these neurons are not activated if the meaningfulness of the movement, of the trajectory of the movement, is lost. So that can be experimentally manipulated, and that kind of relating to the other animal seems to be an important function for these mirror neurons.
So how does that then apply to the behavior of people? Is that, in a sense, if I can say what I would think and then correct me, that if I'm an immigrant from Guatemala and I come up to the border and then I see the way that some of my friends or colleagues have been treated when they arrive here and getting sent back or putting through bureaucratic hoops?
I've got a personal story that I can tell you about that's good. Really funny. But before I get into that, the idea of living on the border where you see a lot of aggression towards people that are trying to come across to create a better life for themselves, there's a lot of us who identify with that culture because we are from that culture. And I remember when I was in Arizona, a friend of mine had asked me to pick up something at his house, and he said, if I'm not there, just jump the fence from the back. And I said, I'm not going to do that. You know, I think the experiences that I grew up with make me more wary about what could happen, how that could be perceived if I'm jumping a fence. My friend, who's Caucasian, said, I would have never thought about that being a problem, right. You know. So what we observe certainly shapes our fears and our expectations of what the consequences are going to be.
Which, of course, is as it should be. Otherwise, what do they say? Once bitten, twice shy or something like that. I mean, you learn from experience.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very apt example. I have sometimes characterized the difference between myself in anthropology and sociology with respect to psychology is that, we pick up these things when it involves thousands and millions of people. I said to my students, I can't study something if it doesn't involve at least a million people. But these are very important right now. At this moment, we're carrying out a very unfortunate, I won't call it experiment, but a very unfortunate policy, but that it will have these consequences of people experiencing trauma both directly and vicariously, indirectly, by sending asylum seekers back to Mexico to wait for their court cases, and also by obstructing their ability to follow them through, like making it very hard for them to get legal representation. And in going back in a very violent environment where until a couple of days ago, people were living in tents at the bottoms of the bridges in this cold weather in El Paso. And there certainly are not enough homes. There's many tens of thousands of people who are homeless because of this.
But you used the initial word experiment, and then you changed it to policy. I'm intrigued by the subtle distinction there, right?
Right. So I think,
do you dismiss the concept of experiment? Because societies are always twiddling at the edges.
I am in the process of trying to set up research to gather evidence about the effect of this. It's not an experiment in a classic way that we have a control or we are able to manipulate people, and that would probably be unethical. And I hesitate to say experiment because experiment makes it seem like it's excused. Because, okay, this is just a way to find out what happens when you do this to people. No, it's a policy in the sense that it's a deliberate act of cruelty.
Yeah, it's a policy which in theory could be changed.
But it is knowledge. We can and should gather knowledge about it and use our understanding of this psychological level to understand the effect of this trauma on people.
In neuroscience, we can take advantage of animal models to understand the neurophysiological effects that probably mediate some of the behavioral effects that Joe would be looking at in the natural environment.
Right. So there's a natural congruence for the two of you.
And many of the people who are involved in this process of – it's called the migrant protection protocols, which is absolutely precisely the opposite of the truth. It's not protecting them in the least to send them to Sierra Juarez. Many of the people who are affected by this are children. So if there are, there's still developmental processes in which their brains are being organized and reorganized, then they're going to be heavily affected by this.
Long-term, permanent.
Especially for children when there's so much development taking place. All the circuits aren't connected yet.
Right. Tell me, Joe, when you think about your first comments last time on the program, do you see historically that this is not something new to the 21st century on this border here, but traditionally societies have, you know, gathered themselves around a leader, godlike figure, you know, and then within the community they are, thou shalt not kill, but of course thou shalt slaughter anybody that tries to invade our little group. This is a historically reproduced concept.
It's not totally new. However, we're doing it with much greater
efficiency.
Power, efficiency, technology, larger numbers. And I think those are qualitatively new developments. That's part of why we're so horrified by the Nazis, and in a less thorough way, but also enormous and massive, the Stalin's Gulag, because those were industrial scale processes of isolating, rounding up people, killing them, doing forced labor and so forth. But to go back,
which only had one goal. And
right.
That was to get rid of that group of people, way or another.
Human history has its very bad side as well as its very good side. And human beings are extraordinarily capable of both empathy and sympathy and sanctuary through the millennia. This is a long time theme, of course, can be found in many religious documents, including the Bible. And on the other hand, persecution. That's part of the logic of sanctuary. So, there is an important turning point in human history. And it's also a turning point in the Anthropocene, which I talked about last time, which is when we get highly unequal, concentrated, densely settled societies. And that takes place as a sequence of steps since about 6,000, 5,000 years ago. And once they get really set into place, like really effective ancient empires, those empires do conduct war against people, and not just against their military opponents, but against civilians that are in the way also.
Especially when there's a threat to resources.
Yeah.
We'll come back to this after a quick break. This is Keith Pannell, Joe Hyman from Sociology, Anthropology, Eddie Castaneda from Psychology. Don't go away. Welcome back to part two of the Castaneda-Hyman Show. This is Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. And we're going to carry on the conversation that we began last week. And Eddie, we're going to come back to you with what some other areas that you think have been really quite novel and new. And in fact, I know a little bit already what you guys are going to talk about. Border studies. So what on earth is a psychologist going to be doing with border studies?
Anything that has to do with behavior is what psychology is about. And so psychology enters into many different kinds of problems that in society. I think the one that I like to focus on is that challenge of translational work, where you take basic neurological research, animal research, and how it applies to a human condition. And so I think I'd like to highlight the work of one of my colleagues, Dr. Sergio Iniguez, who's studying some work looking at physical stress versus just witnessed stress. And he has a very unique model where...
Just explain what that means. Physical stress means you actually do something to the species, the animal, the person. The other is just you see something unpleasant, and that's...
That's right. And these are two different types of stresses that are combined in the manipulation. So experimentally, he has one strain of mouse that's typically a larger mouse in its home environment, and introduces a small mouse into the home environment of the larger mouse. The larger mouse will attack the small mouse, and I'll make sure to clarify that we don't allow any mice to be hurt. Okay, so these are very controlled studies. But there's a physical interaction between the two animals, and of course, the larger animal will dominate. And so this smaller animal experiences physical stress. In the meantime, there's a see-through clear wall, and on the other side of this wall, there's another mouse of the same strain as a smaller one that simply observes that interaction.
And can hear also?
And can hear also, because there's some small holes drilled so that the animal can also experience the smells and the sounds. And so it turns out that there's long-term changes in terms of sensitivity to drugs of abuse in both the animal that experiences physical abuse as well as the observed stress. And I think that's just fascinating to think about how that translates to our border situation.
What are you measuring to indicate this is happening?
So what's really unique about this research is that it's very interdisciplinary. It measures protein changes in the brain, and it measures the propensity for an animal to ingest a drug of abuse. There's an increased propensity for drug abuse, if you will, in this model.
For both the animal that's in with the big bully and the one who's watching it.
Absolutely.
So there's a parallel response from the one outside to the one inside.
Yes.
That's what the end result is saying, right?
That's correct. And so we're looking at changes in vulnerability and in resilience as well.
Okay. Yeah. I remember just about 2 weeks ago on the BBC, they had a program very appropriate for this discussion, that one of the BBC reporters went, I think, to France or Denmark, I can't remember which, for participating in an experiment where she was on the outside, let's say, mm-hmm. watching someone on the inside. But the one on the inside, and this is metaphorical inside, I mean, they were both in the same location, was being given electrical stimulations to some part of the body. And, you know, this was not exactly painful, but uncomfortable. And they were both measuring their brain responses. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the person who was being subjected to the electrical stimulation, and therefore pain to a certain extent, certainly discomfort, certain parts of the brain would light up. The person watching was also being looked at, similar parts of the brain. That is, that they were talking about empathy, that it is clearly showing that people are rather empathetic, and what they see, they can actually feel for themselves. Same idea, perhaps.
That's right. Those are called mirror neurons, where the same brain circuits turn on. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of studies with animals that show that, for example, in non-human primates, if you show an animal that a different animal is picking up a ball, for example, the areas that are involved in the motor control of that sequence of movements in the observing animal also light up.
Oh, but I see that in football. I watch a lot of English soccer, and I'm always kicking the ball when I think it should be kicked.
What's really quite interesting is that these neurons are not activated if the meaningfulness of the movement, of the trajectory of the movement, is lost.
Uh-huh.
So that can be experimentally manipulated, and that kind of relating to the other animal seems to be an important function for these mirror neurons.
So how does that then apply to the behavior of people? Is that, in a sense, if I can say what I would think and then correct me, that if I'm an immigrant from Guatemala and I come up to the border and then I see the way that some of my friends or colleagues have been treated when they arrive here and getting sent back or putting through bureaucratic hoops?
I've got a personal story that I can tell you about that's
good.
Really funny. But before I get into that, the idea of living on the border where you see a lot of aggression towards people that are trying to come across to create a better life for themselves, there's a lot of us who identify with that culture because we are from that culture. And I remember when I was in Arizona, a friend of mine had asked me to pick up something at his house, and he said, if I'm not there, just jump the fence from the back. And I said, I'm not going to do that. You know, I think the experiences that I grew up with make me more wary about what could happen, how that could be perceived if I'm jumping a fence. My friend, who's Caucasian, said, I would have never thought about that being a problem,
right.
You know. So what we observe certainly shapes our fears and our expectations of what the consequences are going to be.
Which, of course, is as it should be. I mean, otherwise, I mean, what do they say? Once bitten, twice shy or something like that. I mean, you learn from experience.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very apt example. I have sometimes characterized the difference between myself in anthropology and sociology with respect to psychology is that, you know, we pick up these things when it involves thousands and millions of people. I've said to my students, I can't study something if it doesn't involve at least a million people. So that's but these are very important right now at this moment. We're carrying out a very unfortunate, I won't call it experiment, but a very unfortunate policy, but that it will have these consequences of people experiencing trauma both directly and vicariously, indirectly. I mean, by sending asylum seekers back to Mexico to wait for their court cases, and also by obstructing their ability to follow them through, like making it very hard for them to get legal representation. And in going back in a very violent environment where until a couple of days ago, people were living in tents at the bottoms of the bridges in this cold weather in El Paso. And there certainly are not enough homes. There's many tens of thousands of people who are homeless because
right.
of this.
But you used the initial word experiment, and then you changed it to policy. I'm intrigued by the subtle distinction there, right?
Right. So I think...
Do you dismiss the concept of experiment? Because societies are always twiddling at the edges.
I am in the process of trying to set up research to gather evidence about the effect of this. It's not an experiment in a classic way that we have a control or we are able to manipulate people, and that would probably be unethical. And I hesitate to say experiment because experiment makes it seem like it's excused. Because, okay, this is just a way to find out what happens when you do this to people. No, it's a policy in the sense that it's a deliberate act of cruelty.
Yeah, it's a policy which in theory could be changed.
But it is knowledge.
It into the experiment.
We can and should gather knowledge about it and use our understanding of this psychological level to understand the effect of this trauma on people.
In neuroscience, we can take advantage of animal models to understand the neurophysiological effects that probably mediate some of the behavioral effects that Joe would be looking at in the natural environment.
Right. So there's a natural congruence for the two of you.
And many of the people who are involved in this process of – it's called the migrant protection protocols, which is absolutely precisely the opposite of the truth. It's not protecting them in the least to send them to Sierra Juarez. Many of the people who are affected by this are children. Mm-hmm. So if there are, you know, there's still developmental processes in which their brains are being organized and reorganized, then they're going to be heavily affected by this.
Long-term, permanent.
Especially for children when there's so much development taking place, all the circuits aren't connected yet.
Right. Tell me, Joe, when you think about your first comments last time on the program, do you see historically that this is not something new to the 21st century on this border here, but traditionally societies have, you know, gathered themselves around a leader, godlike figure, you know, and then within the community, they are, thou shalt not kill, but of course thou shalt slaughter anybody that tries to invade our little group. This is a historically reproduced concept.
It's not totally new. However, we're doing it with much greater
efficiency.
Power, efficiency, technology, larger numbers. And I think those are qualitatively new developments. That's part of why we're so horrified by the Nazis, and in a less thorough way, but also enormous and massive, the Stalin's Gulag, because those were industrial scale processes of isolating, rounding up people, killing them. Doing forced labor and so forth. But to go back...
Which only had one goal, and right. that was to get rid of that group of people way or another.
Human history has its very bad side as well as its very good side, and human beings are extraordinarily capable of both empathy and sympathy and sanctuary through the millennia. This is a long-time theme, of course, can be found in many religious documents, including the mm-hmm. Bible. And on the other hand, persecution. That's part of the logic of sanctuary. So, no, this is there is an important turning point in human history. And it's also a turning point in the Anthropocene, which I talked about last time, which is when we get highly unequal, concentrated, densely settled societies. And that takes place as a sequence of steps since about 6,000, 5,000 years ago. And once they get really set into place, like really effective ancient empires. Those empires do conduct war against people, and not just against their military opponents, but against civilians that are in the way also.
Especially when there's a threat to resources.
Yeah.
We'll come back to this after a quick break, as I'm demanded of by my producer, Sam. So we're going to take a break. This is Keith Pannell, Joe Hyman from Sociology, Anthropology, Eddie Castaneda from Psychology. Don't go away. Welcome back, Keith Pannell, Joe Hyman. No, shouldn't laugh. Welcome back, Keith Pannell, Joe Hyman, and Eddie Castaneda. And just before we took a break, we got onto this business of historically people, you know, not being very pleasant all the time to others, especially foreigners and strangers. But that brings up a point. Going back to the concept that, Eddie, you were talking about, empathy, that where the same types of response in the brain when someone's watching somebody else in distress, the person who's empathetic can see and feel that same response in their head or in their brain. Mm-hmm. That means there's a lot of people who don't have that. There are non-empathetic people that could inflict an awful lot of pain and damage and seemingly just, hey, sure, it's another, excuse me, hey, it's just another day at the office.
I think that humans are wired to socialize. It provides safety. It provides a technique to thrive. And I think that probably the circuits for socializing have developed much more in humans. You see it in other animals as well. Marine mammals, for example, dolphins and whales show that as well.
Mm-hmm.
They show hunting together. They show protective behavior for each other. And so I think that spans across a number of different species.
But my point is, though, that there are people who clearly don't have any empathy with the victim that they are persecuting.
That's right.
So, again, going back to this BBC program, they interviewed a person that was well known in his circle for not being able to exhibit empathy. He didn't do bad things, but he just didn't worry when he saw bad things going on. And he said, I must say, it's been rather helpful in my life because otherwise I'd be so worried all the time. But it didn't impact him.
But I would jump in there and say that it's not only a degree of empathy with everybody that might be out there and their needs and merits also. But the other thing about it is that the social science side of it is the categorization as deserving of empathy or not deserving of empathy. So we have these human equipment in our brain, which our species nature, this capacity to be highly social and highly empathetic. But it's oftentimes guided in some directions and not others. And so there are
subjectivity to this.
Yeah, there are certain types of insiders who deserve help and other types of outsiders who can be left out on the street.
It's a nature-nurture kind of discussion. But I don't like that term because it oversimplifies the situation.
Yeah,
but definitely.
That's exactly right. So what we see with borders, we'll go back to borders. Borders are one of the ways that these sorts of lines of insiders and outsiders are drawn. Or for that matter, borders are ways that they're penetrated. I mean, this is one of the great contradictions of borders and some of the work that we've been doing here at the Center for Inter-American and Border Studies has been exactly to try to understand the ways that the two sides of the border are interactive and connected, even though they're very, very different also.
And that brings up the unique situation for First People or Native Americans that go across a border as a natural geography for them and how that's being challenged.
And the Roma in Europe. I mean, I got good friends in Romania that tell all sorts of wonderful stories about when Ceausescu was in power and how difficult it was to get a passport to leave the country. And you'd spend ages trying to get it and then probably couldn't. And he went once and then 2 months later he came back and he met somebody else in there that was applying for one, who was a Roma, and said, oh, well, I've already visited the country I wanted to visit because I don't bother about borders. But now this is for another one, just to be legally having applied for it, regardless of whether they get it. You know, some people are adept at this.
I mean, later this year, we're going to come out with a I'm co-editor with a book about documents and that whole thing. But the Roma is a classic example of people who have been stigmatized, turned into dangerous others, and have been persecuted. They were enslaved in Romania for centuries there. They were killed by the Nazis. So that's one of the classic examples of this process of cutting people off.
Growing up in England, I was warned, you know, because we had Romani caravans. They weren't encampments. They had horses and caravans, very brightly colored and decorated. But I was always told, you know, be careful, right? I don't quite know what of. But, of course, a natural instinct for a 10-year-old is to want to see this apparition, you know, going through suburban London. But anyway, I think we'd like to go to the last. I would like to have you go to this last segment. How many minutes do we have? We have 10? Okay. Okay. Any further thoughts on what we've just been talking? Eddie, Joe, or are we happy to move on?
Well, I will throw out there that there are that a couple of people in the political science department, Eusebio Lobos and Chidam Siedin, are working on empathy.
Yeah.
And in the case of immigration.
Okay.
So you may or may not use that.
No, we won't use that, but it's worth doing. Joe, are you listening or are you sleeping in there? You're thinking. Okay, good man. So we'll cut all this out, and then now I'm going to change topics, okay? Well, this has been a fascinating discussion, gentlemen. But I'd like to now go to the same question that I asked the other people that have been on this sort of reprise of the past and the future of science. Science, in my opinion, in North America is under attack. All right. I think that we don't have the support of a large swath of the population because they want immediate answers and scientists don't tend to give immediate answers. And then when we do, they say, well, wait a minute, there are some of you that don't agree. So I'd like to get your feelings individually. Where do you think science is in 21st century United States of America? Eddie.
So I see it as an upward trend. There's certainly a lot of innovation taking place. But I think that the question that you're asking has to do about how people perceive science, right?
Yes.
And so the problem I think that happens is that there's a lot of people that haven't attained the kind of education that scientists have simply because they've gone in different directions. They have different experiences, but they don't know what science is about. They don't understand what science is about. I'll tell you, when I started taking my science courses, it was a different language. And I see it as a different culture. And so everybody goes into a different culture, and we don't understand other cultures, and that creates a problem. Science can be something that's very different. It can be scary for those
that
don't
understand.
Did you
always want to be a scientist of some description?
And as I look back at growing up, I was always curious. Yeah. And so I did in that sense, although I didn't define it as being sciencey, if you will.
Okay. Yeah. But so you're saying that it's a matter of lack of education and understanding. That must have then the responsibility thrown back at the scientists, that we're not doing enough to bring lay people into our daily discussions, thought processes, or not going doing enough, I guess, outreach is the big word.
I think that's right. We tend to think we overwork ourselves. And so we spend 80 hours a week working. And so to add that extra time for outreach, mm-hmm. I think it's programs like this one that you have here, Keith, that are really crucial to get it out to the lay people.
Let's hope so.
Get that understanding out.
Yeah. Joe, do you have a feeling that your branch of science is misunderstood or not respected enough, or that you can't? Because you're really on the forefront of being able to make, and I'm not going to go away from it, political decisions have sometimes to be made on scientific knowledge.
Right.
And you more than, say, most of us at this table.
I think we experience in anthropology, which is anthropology's fundamental concept is evolution. So I think people have understood the importance of evolution and will come back to understanding it, but it's been criticized. And I grew up with people who were both scientists and religious, so they saw the evolution as an expression of God. And we are it's very important in my field. I talked before about the Anthropocene. Global climate change and Earth surface change, environmental change, are crucial concepts. So there's a lot of resistance to these. But I don't want to say, oh, poor, poor, pitiful me. I'm deeply appreciative of the public support in the United States and around the world for science. And I think it's very important to defend that public support. I think it's important to defend the concept of the inexpensive and open public university, because that's how people learn about science. I mean, that really the university is should be a learning environment.
Yeah, let me go back now to Eddie. Does your discipline have much in the way of outreach activity to the lay public? I mean, do you expect your faculty to go and give talks to the Elks or the Scottish Rite Temple people, or whatever?
We don't outright expect them to, but as a part of their service obligation to the university, anytime that they utilize their professional skills, for example, in outreach, that certainly counts as part of their employment.
I was just wondering. I'd be interested to know if there's a record over the last, say, 10 years of people from the quote-unquote scientific community going out, talking in churches, cornering their political representatives. I don't think it happens as much as you think it should.
I'm a behavioral neuroscientist, and I belong to the Society for Neuroscience,
right,
which sponsors a Brain Week, which is an outreach program. They bring in children to learn about neuroscience. They get to touch brains and talk about.
Do we do it here?
We do it a little bit here, but not as organized as we should be doing it.
All right. Is it, and Joe, in anthropology, do we?
There is a organization, there's a wider and more academic organization in anthropology, American Anthropological Association, but there's a smaller but still big organization called the Society for Applied Anthropology, which started around 1940, so it's very long lasting. I was on the national board of the Society for Applied Anthropology, and we'll have our upcoming meeting in March in Albuquerque. And the whole idea of it is that of doing anthropology that is relevant to the world and increasingly in collaboration with communities. So Native American communities, farmers markets, you name it. I mean, in a place where the knowledge might matter, and in particular collaborating on creating translational, creating effective knowledge. That's the dedication of the Society for Applied Anthropology. And so, yeah, in terms of migration and border studies, we really are dedicated to doing that here in El Paso Juarez.
Right. Well, I mean, if you weren't doing it here, where else would you really find the focus so intense? Eddie, just I think the last President Obama put a lot of money, or at least I remember him saying he was going to put a lot of money into neuroscience. That was the new frontier. Mm. I mean, do you see that, and do your colleagues see that? And so, in fact, this is going to be a golden age for neuroscience?
There has been an increase in funding recently, but, you know, I don't it's not as much as we need.
Oh, wow.
We always seem to work with less than we need. It's not a significant amount of money for the kind of work that needs to be done.
Okay.
And yeah.
One other question to both of you, because one of the other things that is causing science to be looked at askance, if you like, is this concept of retractions, reproducibility, and large important papers, especially in translational medicine, not being able to be reproduced. In your field, how many papers do you think in the top journals of neuroscience are not reproducible?
That's certainly becoming a big topic,
right.
Especially in, for example, social psychology. I hear a lot about it. I don't hear as much about it in neuroscience, probably because the experiments in neuroscience are more controlled.
Right.
But it's certainly becoming a big factor.
It's something that you pay attention to in your graduate programs and discuss this?
Yes, we're discussing it quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. And Joe, is this concept important in sociology?
I mean, we don't usually have experimental situations, except for a few things that are connected to psychology, social psychology. But usually we're studying the naturally occurring world, statistics, in the case of sociology, or doing ethnography
statistics
and living in a community.
Right.
And so there is a difficulty with how reliable are the observations no matter what.
Okay. We got to finish there. Sam is telling me that our 28 allotted minutes are up. I never quite understood what happens if we do 31. Everything gets fouled up on Sunday night. But anyway, Eddie Castaneda, as usual, man, great pleasure.
Thank you so
seeing
much.
You and talking with you. Joe, thank you very much.
It's been
a lot of fun.
Very good.
And Sam,
very
thank you for putting it together. It's going to sound wonderful. And we'll be back next week with some totally different program. Enough of 2019, enough of the future. Let's find out what's happening in a totally different area of science. So you be there. Thank you very much for being here. Bye-bye.